war.
That was our primary objective and interest.
Well, Mr. Murphy, why do you think he resented you personally? He wrote about you in a rather uncomplimentary fashion, as I remember.
Well, he did once or twice. On the other hand, I'll see the lighter strain. There were several compliments from time to time.
Right.
But he blamed me for the exclusion of the free French forces as part of the Roosevelt staff in excluding him. Now, there was one other misunderstanding which is worth mentioning there. You may remember a French admiral by the name of Darlan who was assassinated on Christmas Eve in 1942. Led to a telegram from General de Gaulle in London to General Giraud, in which de Gaulle asked Giraud to meet with him at any place he wished to so that they could discuss matters and come to a conciliatory point of view. The trouble was, we never heard of that message, which went personally to General Giraud. General Giraud was a five-star general who regarded General de Gaulle still as a captain. And I think that military relationship was one of the things that militated against our progress at the time. So de Gaulle then blamed us for the fact that he received no reply from General Giraud to his offer. And I think in that connection, he blamed me for it. I never heard of the telegram. That's just one little item.
Ambassador Bolin, you were with Roosevelt a good deal in those years. I had a kind of a visceral feeling that Mr. Roosevelt himself sort of wanted to be the great liberator for the French people. Maybe that was quite wrong. Why did he resent the goal?
I can't speak too much on Roosevelt's attitude towards France, but as I understood it, and I heard him a couple of times mention it during the trip back from the Yalta Conference, and I think his general idea was that he just did not know what the French people wanted, and he did not wish the American army, which would be an occupation, so-called, of France during the war, to be forced to impose any one man on the French people. I really think that this was his main thought that he had in regard to the future disposition of France. There was one thing that I think did really irritate the President Roosevelt a great deal, and that was that when Harry Hopkins came through Paris, we were on our way to Yalta, he thought that he had from the French an indication that de Gaulle might be willing to meet President Roosevelt anywhere on French soil. So a very warm telegram was cooked up from Yalta to the French Foreign Office through our embassy in Paris, and the reply of General de Gaulle was not exactly that of an acceptance. He said he could not come because he had some dates with some resistance group in France. Roosevelt was very angry indeed, and it took a good deal of work on the part of Harry Hopkins, a little bit aided by myself, to make him tone down the telegram or the communique that he was about to put out.
Do you think things would have gone better later on if he had gone to Yalta for that meeting?
I don't know. I think that de Gaulle's views on the future of the world were pretty well established by the time he came, when he was in power. I thought he'd thought them up and considered them very carefully in the pre-war period. And, of course, his one fixation was on France. France, the entity, the conception of France. He realized, of course, that France didn't have all the power in the world, but he thought that her civilization, her history, and her tradition would give her a special place.
Eric, there's one thing that I think I'd like to ask, and we hear about missed telegrams and very personal reactions, and one of the things that occurred to me today, that this is not only the last of the figures of World War II, but the last of the colorful leaders. There are a lot of faceless men around the world, and it seemed to me I saw even in General Nurse's reaction a fact that he enjoyed General de Gaulle even when it didn't work. Now, are we all going to miss that kind of a man?
Well, my experience is somewhat different, I think, than Ambassador Murphy or Ambassador Bolin's, in that it was official in nature. It started in the basis of an official relationship, but I look at it not only today, but have looked at it for many, many years as a rather personal thing. And I think there's an aspect of this man that is not well known to Americans. I think there was There's a warmth about him, a liveliness about him, a great sense of humor in the man. I think he had some very strange quirks, some strange characteristics. For instance, one thing I think both the ambassadors agree with me on is that he disliked soldiers. I mean, he disliked generals. But that was not, that wasn't exceptional, because I had the feeling he didn't like Frenchmen for a long period of time.
General Norstad, you're probably the last American to have heard from General de Gaulle. I think you said for the program that you'd had a copy of his book from him.
Well, I was very honored and very very flattered when last Friday I received a copy of his latest book very nicely, and I think this illustrates my point. So immodestly, I might tell you what the inscription was, signed just exactly a month ago to General Norstad, in witness of my very cordial and faithful memories, signed C. de Gaulle. And that was, the signature was of the 8th of October of this year. And I think that's characteristic, really, of my relationship with him. I was, I think, as in the case with the other great men, and there aren't too many of those whom I have known, that there's always some quality of awe in the association, and there always was in my relationship with General de Gaulle. On the other hand, it seemed very natural to me, and I was very impressed with when at the end of one of our meetings he walked out with his hand on my arm or his hand around my back and walked me through two, three offices to the head of the stairs or even down to the door. This was a personal relationship. I felt, I frankly felt, in spite of the, I did preside over the NATO forces in Europe at the time of perhaps the greatest difficulty, ending in January 63 when I left. And yet, during that period, I developed a feeling of respect for the man, but I would say also an affection.
There's one thing I wish you gentlemen would address yourself to, maybe starting with Ambassador Murphy. Mr. Severin Schreiber said, indicated, that overall there was an atmosphere of failure about Charles de Gaulle. What would you think, sir?
Oh, I don't know about failure. I think that de Gaulle had great ambitions, some of which obviously were not fulfilled. His target was very big. But I never had the feeling that the psychology of failure affected him. Quite the contrary. I think he had an inherent confidence in himself and drove himself terribly. But I never detected defeatism on his part.
Ambassador Boland, do you think his successes outweighed his failures?
I think as far as France was concerned, they undoubtedly did. There's no doubt about it that he did a great deal for that nation. And I don't think that we always understood the depth of the French feeling of humiliation after 1940. And when de Gaulle came back to power in 1958, practically averting what would have been a civil war of Algeria, he gave restored French morale, gave them a shot in the arm, and really restored their self-confidence. And I think that persists. And referring to the previous question about whether he was a failure or not, I think that he can charge that as a substantial success. What I don't think he did, and I'm not speaking of his foreign policy, he really wanted to remake the institutions of France, and this he was not successful in doing.
Mr. Ambassador, one roundhouse question, hypothetical question, really. If he had not taken the attitude he took after the war, do you think there would have been a kind of political United States of Europe, a real federation of those countries?
I think personally that probably one of the things that history may judge General de Gaulle on harshly was his failure his obstacle that he put in the way of the creation of a genuinely unified Europe. I mean, the beginnings of it. Everybody knew it would take a long time. But I think if General de Gaulle had had a slightly different attitude towards it, that he could easily have been the first president of a federated Europe, even during his lifetime.
You're talking what time frame?
Western Europe. I'm talking in the time frame from the time he came back in 1958.
General Norstedt, maybe General de Gaulle was right in feeling that the defense of France must rest essentially on the French, since we're going to take some troops out of NATO next year. The British are not beefing up. Nobody's beefing up. Did he foresee all this?
In fact, I don't think he ever thought that the defense of France depended upon the French forces. He had, when he had withdrawn the forces in principle, he still told us informally that we were to plan on the use of those forces. And he told me, the time that I left, that he said that you knew that if there were any emergency of any kind, who would be the commander of the French forces, meaning that I would have been the commander of the French forces. And he told me many times that I would be, so I replied in the affirmative that I understood that I would be.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. One of the best books ever written about the contemporary French, and of course de Gaulle, was entitled France Against Herself. That struggle was epitomized in the life and career of Charles de Gaulle. When he died, his successor, Georges Pompidou, said today, "De Gaulle is dead, France is a widow." Much earlier, the great Charles said of himself, "De Gaulle is not on the left, nor on the right, nor in the center. He is above." Not a modest statement, but an accurate one.
Hello?
John?
Yes.
This is Juan Pettis.
Yes.
We lost Papa last night.
Oh, my. It has come. I hate to see Mabel.
Well,
yes.
So far. Impact will come later, I guess.
Yes. Yes. Oh, you over there?
Yeah, I'm over here.
Yes.
We were out here last night. We spent the night out here with them.
Oh, did you?
Paul and I were here.
Well, what would you expect? What could anybody in your neighbors do?
Beg your pardon?
What could any of your neighbors do?
Well, there's nothing, you know, for the time being.
We just stand by.
Yeah, the funeral will probably be on Friday afternoon. We'll definitely have to call.
All right.
We'll talk to them up there, but we would like it on Friday afternoon if it's possible, for them to arrange it. To probably about 2:00 on Friday, graveside service out at Oak Ridge, which is, between Rochelle and Metanope.
Yes.
And, so this is the tentative arrangement, and so just wanted you to know.
Oh, I appreciate it. We were just sitting here talking about him.
Well, I got in touch with Florence. I talked with her last night. She came to the VA yesterday to try to see him. She's been moved to intensive care, but she didn't get to go in. She was going to come out here to see Big Mama this morning and then try to see him, in a day or so. But he didn't just make it. Well, when I got there yesterday, I took her to Jimmy and then came back and went on to Gainesville. He'd been back in intensive care for about 2 hours and he hadn't been able to reach me or her, of course. But at least I feel assured that they did all they could.
Yes.
And he made as comfortable as possible. That's the main thing. But I'll talk to you later, guys.
All right.
Great symbolic cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. Many of the heads of state have already gone into the cathedral and been seated. Prince Charles, the heir to the throne of Great Britain, Prime Minister...
...in Column Bay, Les Douze Églises. The mass this morning in the Notre Dame Cathedral was attended by thousands of Frenchmen and 83 heads of state, presidents, premiers, and kings, among them President Nixon, who now plans to meet with French President Pompidou at the Élysée Palace, where they expect to watch the burial on French television. All dignitaries are forbidden to attend the burial by de Gaulle's own wishes. It will be in the village where he retired a year and a half ago, 100 miles from Paris, the village of Column Bay, Les Douze Églises. Charles Collingwood is in the studios of the French National Television Network, where this morning he observes and reports the events from France. Charles?
We're watching one part of the main square in Column Bay, Les Douze Églises. Far from Paris and the splendors of Notre Dame, where this morning's ceremony was. This is part of the honor guard of about 120 men representing the various arms of the French services outside the little church where de Gaulle used to go and attend services every Sunday, and where there will be a solemn ceremony for him before he is laid to rest in the way that he had wished it, with a minimum of ceremony. He will be buried in the family tomb where his daughter, who was mentally retarded and died young, lies, where his wife will be buried in her time. De Gaulle had explicitly forbidden any fuss or pomp or great personages in attendance here at Column Bay, Les Douze Églises, but he also said that the men and women of France and the world could come if they wished, and as you can see, they have come. A huge mass of humanity, which seems even more numerous because the village itself is so tiny, less than 400 souls. And the French have come here from all walks of life and all parts of France, and they're here waiting for the cortege, which will soon bear his coffin on an armored military vehicle. Many of these people have waited all night. It will be as de Gaulle had wished, his family, his friends, and the people of France. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris.
Charles de Gaulle once said he was France. After France fell to the Nazis, much of the world saw him the same way. Charles Collingwood prepared this story on the life the world is honoring today.
Charles de Gaulle, President of France, was a towering figure in our world. Many disagree with him, many dislike him, but no one can ignore him. Through the force of his personality and the thrust of his sense of history, he has given France a controversial and disproportionate role in world affairs. The history of Charles de Gaulle is all mixed up in the history of modern France. It's a story of a progress from defeat and humiliation to affluence and world power. When World War II began, he was a slightly overage colonel of 49. Just important enough to be photographed at the front with French President Lebrun. When the phony war ended and the real war began, de Gaulle collected what armor he could to delay the German advance. He was able to put his theories of warfare into practice in two brilliant and successful, if minor, tank actions. He was promoted to Brigadier General. As France began to disintegrate militarily and politically, luck, or perhaps it was destiny, began to take a hand in de Gaulle's career. Paul Reynaud became the last premier of France and named de Gaulle to his cabinet. It is likely that in all his long career, this minor appointment was the most important thing Reynaud ever did. De Gaulle was in Reynaud's government for only 11 days. 11 days in which the whole fabric of France was crumbling. The Reynaud government was on the run. It ran to Bordeaux as far as it could go, and on the 17th of June, Reynaud resigned rather than surrender. As Reynaud's emissary, de Gaulle had met General Spears, who acted as Churchill's liaison with the French army. Like Reynaud, Spears was to be an agent of destiny for de Gaulle. De Gaulle was determined to escape, and after laying an elaborate false trail,
Spears got him out to London. By flying at a dangerously low altitude, they escaped detection by both the Germans and the French high command, who planned to arrest de Gaulle. Because of his role, Spears is sometimes called the man who invented de Gaulle.
He was not selected by the British. Some people think so, but that's a mistake. General de Gaulle became head of the Free French because he was the only Frenchman who was prepared to come over and fight on our side.
No other remotely important French figure came to London. De Gaulle, a brigadier general, ex-junior cabinet minister, hardly known in France, anonymous in Britain, became the ranking Frenchman in London. De Gaulle found himself leading the Free French movement. In the beginning, many Frenchmen were reluctant to rally to de Gaulle's cause. His troops were largely evacuees from Dunkirk, a brigade which escaped from Norway, and assorted sailors and airmen who were stranded in Britain. Many chose to return to occupied France rather than fight under the Cross of Lorraine. The French embassy in London disowned him. Even the support of the British was tentative. General Spears recalls,
he had a very rough passage. Very rough passage with us. He felt he couldn't trust us. We were looking after ourselves first. I think we always tried to give him a fair deal, but it wasn't at all easy. He was quite alone on foreign soil, abused by his countrymen, condemned to death as a deserter by his former chiefs, denounced by his embassy, with not a penny to his name, utterly dependent upon his host, Winston Churchill. Without the latter, there would have been no de Gaulle and no Free French. France owes Churchill her existence. De Gaulle accepted complete solitude by refusing from the first to share his responsibility with anyone. He never asked for and seldom accepted advice. He grew to like suffering. He was deficient in a sense of humor. He once told me, "I really am Joan of Arc."
By Bastille Day 1942, de Gaulle and his Free French were well established. The British put up with him and continued to help, and if the United States barely tolerated him, he had caught the imagination of the public. Even General Eisenhower turned out to do France honor, and thus indirectly to honor Charles de Gaulle. To mark the occasion, he made a rare speech in English.
France, at first crushed while acting as a vanguard, will be an essential element in the decisive battle. France will help with all her genius in the reconstruction of a new world, which will arise from the ruins. The hope of France is exactly that so admirably defined by Mr. Wendell Willkie.
Quoting Willkie was a calculated insult to Roosevelt. But de Gaulle felt France was now so important to the Allies he could say what he wished. De Gaulle was becoming too important to be ignored. When Roosevelt and Churchill met in Casablanca early in 1943, they literally had to force de Gaulle to attend. It was an extraordinary gathering. When the invasion of Normandy was launched, Churchill was as out of patience with de Gaulle as was Roosevelt. But they could not ignore him. By the time Allied troops stormed ashore, de Gaulle had become the symbol of France. 9 days after D-Day, de Gaulle was permitted to land in France. He came ashore in that unlikely amphibian vehicle, the Duck. Charles de Gaulle had returned. He was no longer the obscure brigadier general who had fled in 1940, but the acknowledged paladin of free France, and the Cross of Lorraine was his device. Ahead lay his first encounter with the French people, but how would they receive him who had not shared their trials? When he described this day in his memoirs, he characteristically referred to himself not as I or me, but in the third person as General de Gaulle.
We proceeded on foot from street to street. At the sight of General de Gaulle, the inhabitants stood in a kind of daze, then burst into cheering or else into tears. Rushing out of their houses, they followed me in the grip of an extraordinary emotion. The children surrounded me. The women smiled and sobbed. The men shook my hands. We walked on together, all overwhelmed by comradeship, feeling national joy, pride, and hope rise again from the depths of the abyss.
From this moment, de Gaulle moved with even greater confidence. Without Allied authorization, he set up a civil administration in Bayeux, and thereafter, whenever a part of France was liberated. Paris greeted him as a living legend. He exerted a magical effect on the crowds, a magic he has never lost. He set up his command post at the Gare Montparnasse and began to give orders. Among the Allied forces liberating Paris was the famous Free French 2nd Armored Division under General Leclerc. De Gaulle's concept of leadership does not include public displays of emotion. When he patted General Leclerc on the arm in congratulation, it was as spontaneous and uninhibited a gesture as he ever allows himself. The next day was perhaps the most moving of de Gaulle's life. A great parade down the Champs-Élysées, the apotheosis of the liberation. De Gaulle, the chief actor, describes it.
Ahead stretched the Champs-Élysées. It looked more like the sea. A tremendous crowd was jammed together on both sides of the road. Perhaps 2 million people. I went on foot. This was not the moment for a parade, with arms glittering and the sound of trumpets. Today, we were to revive, by the sight of its joy and the evidence of its liberty, the self-awareness of a people who yesterday were crushed by defeat and scattered in servitude. Since each of those here had chosen Charles de Gaulle in his heart as the refuge against his agony and as the symbol of his hopes, I must allow the man to be seen in order that at this sight national unity might shine forth.
At the Place de la Concorde, de Gaulle switched to an open car. He described the rest of this dramatic day.
I went on, touched yet tranquil, amid the inexpressible exaltation of the crowd, beneath the storm of voices echoing my name, trying, as I advanced, to look at every person in all that multitude, in order that every eye might register my presence, raising and lowering my arms to reply to the cheers. This was one of those miracles of national consciousness, one of those gestures which sometimes in the course of centuries light up the history of France.
His cavalcade picked up speed down the Rue de Rivoli, past the statue of Joan of Arc, who first marched under the Cross of Lorraine.
Towards 4:30, I went as planned to Notre Dame. The moment I stepped out of the car, shots crackled in the square. Everyone who had a weapon began to fire at random, aiming at the roofs. It was immediately apparent to me that this was one of those continuing shooting matches which high feelings sometimes set off in overexcited troops. Nothing could be more important for me not to yield to the crowd. Who had fired the first shots? We never found out.
Surely that is a tableau which must appeal to General de Gaulle. He stands there, alone and unafraid, while all around him give way to panic. While lesser men are distracted by the alarms of the moment, he broods upon their deeper significance, and he takes charge. As the embodiment of a restored and liberated France, he made visits of state to the great powers. On this trip to the United States, he spoke in English in the White House garden.
I am glad to be on American soil, and again to have met President Roosevelt. We have talked, and I found that we have a common understanding of the grave problems facing us.
You ready?
In New York, de Gaulle had to share the spotlight with another master showman, Fiorello LaGuardia.
General Charles de Gaulle, I'm happy and proud to welcome you to the city of New York. You, who are the symbol of fighting France, of liberty-loving France. Vive la France!
Vive la France!
Vive la France!
I thank you very much, Mr. Mayor, on your own, for your exceptionally good and friendly reception. Good luck to you all, men and women, working for the democracy, for the liberty, for the victory. Good luck to you. Long life to New York and to American people.
We hope to continue this story of General de Gaulle's life, but we're interrupting it here because we want to talk at this point about his attitude toward the United States with Adalbert Segunsok, who is the chief correspondent of France Soir, France's largest newspaper. Mr. Segunsok, was Charles de Gaulle's visit then that we just saw, was his attitude toward this country at that time poisoned by President Roosevelt's disdain of him, his view of him as a messiah, did that come later?
No, I think undoubtedly there was ill feeling right from the start. The first thing that happened was the Saint-Pierre and Miquelon incident, where the French decided to occupy an island which was held by the Vichy government. De Gaulle decided, for his own purposes and also because he wanted to have a great amount of French territory under his control. He also wanted to have possessions of territories in different parts of the world to uphold the importance and the presence of France. And this created an extremely bad feeling between the two men. President Roosevelt was furious. He had, just a week before, promised the Vichy government, the French ambassador Vichy in Washington, that he would protect, he would allow the French to remain, the Vichy government to remain in Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. And this upset his plans. It was also part of the Havana Agreement, where he had also promised the South American countries that none of the other foreign powers would be allowed to step in the New World. And because of that, this created the first extremely bad feeling, and from then on, there was misunderstanding between the two men.
Did it color his whole attitude toward this country? He often talked about the American hegemony. Was it just he was unable to forgive Roosevelt? and therefore the American people?
I don't know. There's, I think, one thing which is very badly understood in America, and probably also in the outside world, is that de Gaulle was against nobody. He wasn't anti-American or anti-Anglo-Saxon. De Gaulle was pro-French. It's something which is perhaps difficult to describe. It's a 19th century view of things. But for him, the only thing that mattered was France. What happened to other people mattered only in the context of France. If he thought that America and relations with America was something which could serve France, he would certainly have good relations. If he thought that it would be bad for France, he would have bad relations. And I think as the years went on, he realized that if there was a hegemony of America, a hegemony of Russia, a hegemony of the two big powers, France, which was a country which was weakening, would become a small country, a tiny country. It could still play a role if it could combat that hegemony, and also if it could pitch the two giants against one another, so as to avoid that one should take the domination from the other, because then it would allow France to play a bigger role. And I think that much of what de Gaulle did has to be understood in that context of France exclusive of everything else.
How much of de Gaulle's attitude toward this country is shared by the French people?
I think very little. There was undoubtedly, during the de Gaulle days, a certain number of people, especially in the administration, who shared de Gaulle's views, and there was, in the general public, certain bitterness towards a certain attitude of the American government. But generally, the French people are very pro-American. They are first grateful to Americans for what it has done in two wars. And then also, they are extremely grateful to everything that America represents, the democracy of America, the courage of America.
Thank you. We'll come back to you, Mr. Segonzac, I hope, and talk some more. We're now going to Colombele Duzegli once again, and Charles Collingwood in the studios of the French television network. Charles?
In the courtyard just outside the church where de Gaulle's funeral will be held, the honor guard is lined up, and here things are relatively calm. However, outside, beyond, and all through this drab little town of less than 400 people, there are throngs of people who have come from all over France to be as close as they can get to the interment. In the nature of things, few of these mourners will see or hear very much. One oasis of comparative calm is the de Gaulle house, La Boiserie, where General de Gaulle's body now lies in very modest state in the room where he died as he was laying out a game of solitaire. He is dressed in his brigadier general's uniform and lies in a simple oaken coffin with the flag of France draped over it. The coffin is the same as they make for anyone else in Colombe. The family insisted on it. It cost 350 francs, or less than $65. Comparatively few have been allowed into the house to pay their last respects. The family, some old friends and comrades, the townspeople of whom de Gaulle felt himself one, but not the monarchs, the presidents, and prime ministers with whom he moved on at least equal footing while he was alive. They were relegated earlier this morning to the grandeur of Notre Dame. The ceremony here in Colombe, which will take place in a few minutes now, will be a far cry from the ritual and comparative formality of the cathedral. De Gaulle's pallbearers will be native sons of Colombe les Deux Églises, a butcher's boy, a farmhand, a cheesemaker, three students among the group. The local curé will do most of the service, although the bishop of the area will be there. This will be as de Gaulle had wished. His family, his friends, and the people of France who have come all over. There's a traffic jam 5 miles all around the town as they continue to pour in. With his deep sense of the rightness of things and of his own role in French history, Charles de Gaulle wanted to underline at the last that his true links were with the real France that lies beneath the glitter of her world role he did so much to burnish. And so, in a few minutes now, they will take him to his grave, as he had wished, among his own people. This is Charles Collingwood in Paris.
Thank you, Charles. While we wait for that burial, we're going to pick up your prepared story on de Gaulle's life after World War II ended, when he became
Prime Minister of France, but then quit in disgust to form his own party after a lot of political fragmenting. The party was a failure, and in 1955 he dissolved it and retired. Charles Collingwood now tells us about those years.
De Gaulle retired to his house in the obscure village of Colombey-les-Deux-Églises. A man came up to him once and said, "Things are looking bad, sir. Don't you think they will call you back?" De Gaulle replied, "I'm not sure they are bad enough yet." Charles de Gaulle sat as silent as a sphinx. He made no public statements, but he maintained a voluminous correspondence. Public figures sought him out. He expressed himself to them with such Delphic ambiguity that every faction was sure de Gaulle agreed with them. The army thought he wanted to keep Algeria French. The liberals were certain he wanted France out of Algeria. De Gaulle still said nothing. He appeared in public only on ceremonial occasions, but people talked of his return to power. For things were getting worse for France. The long and costly struggle to maintain France's empire abroad was coming to an end in Algeria. In this sordid and unrewarding effort, the French army, which had known nothing but defeat since 1939, now began to feel itself betrayed and abandoned by the civil authorities. The generals gradually took matters into their own hands. At home, emotions were inflamed. Those who felt with the army that Algeria must remain French at all costs clashed head-on with those who demanded the abandonment of France's colonial empire. If the communists were in the forefront of these demonstrations, the divisions reached into every sector of French life. The chronic instability of French politics became acute. One government succeeded another, as in a kaleidoscope, the familiar faces of Fourth Republic politicians were rearranged into more and more meaningless patterns. From the time de Gaulle resigned until May 1958, there were 23 different governments in France. There was revolution in the air. De Gaulle's house at Colombey became the center of attention. The hour for which he had waited was at hand. On May 19th, the gate of de Gaulle's house at Colombey opened, and the general, in a plain black Citroën sedan, sped toward Paris and power. De Gaulle had agreed to form a government. The moment was grave and the call was clear. He summoned a press conference at a railway station hotel. He was older, heavier, myopic, but he still cast his legendary spell. He said he would form a government if the people wished it. He was asked repeatedly whether he intended to establish a dictatorship. He dealt with that.
Have I ever had any designs on fundamental liberties? I restored them. Have I ever tempered with them? Why should I, at 67, begin to be a dictator?
The National Assembly invested de Gaulle with the authority of the state. It was the 1st of June, a Sunday. De Gaulle demanded special powers and got them. But no parliamentary formality could make the Algerian war go away. De Gaulle made it his first order of business to go in person to Algeria. He was greeted with wild enthusiasm by the Europeans. They felt that they had put him where he was and that they had a claim upon him. Even the Muslims ventured out in his honor.
I declare that as of today, as far as France is concerned, there is one category of inhabitants in Algeria. There are only Frenchmen.
Moi, De Gaulle.
I, De Gaulle, am opening the door to reconciliation.
He began to condition public opinion little by little to accept a negotiated peace in Algeria. By and large, French opinion followed his lead. So much so that the disillusioned army and the European community in Algeria mounted a rebellion against de Gaulle, as they had against his predecessors. But this time, the conspirators were not dealing with the moribund Fourth Republic. They were dealing with Charles de Gaulle.
J'ai pris au nom de la France.
In the name of France, I have made this decision. The Algerians will be free to decide their own destiny.
C'est moi.
I am responsible for the fate of our country. All French soldiers must obey me.
That speech broke the revolt in Algiers. The civilians trooped out from behind their barricades. The army recalled to its duty sternly enforced order. For the first time, the government had refused to bow to the demands of the extremists in Algiers. De Gaulle disciplined the army, mobilized public opinion, and offered the Muslim rebels an honorable peace and a future association with France. But De Gaulle was to face still one more challenge to his authority from Algiers. In April 1961, a group of generals, most of whom de Gaulle had relieved from their commands in Algeria, seized control of Algiers, Oran, and Constantine. Once more, France was on the brink of chaos. Once more, de Gaulle employed the most powerful weapon in his armory, the support of the people. Putting on his uniform again, he called for their help.
Français, aidez-moi.
Not only did the people of France stand firm behind de Gaulle, but in Algeria, the conscript soldiers refused to join the revolt. In 5 days, it was over.
No longer tied down by troubles at home, nor forced to depend upon the United States for protection abroad, de Gaulle was free to follow his own course, and he did.
He was free to stride upon the world stage as he had always wished to do. With President Kennedy, he debated the shape and direction of the Western Alliance. De Gaulle liked Kennedy without agreeing with him. He said of the young president, a true statesman who chooses his goal and holds his course. If he liked the president, he certainly liked Mrs. Kennedy, whose ancestors were French and maiden name was Bouvier. With Chairman Khrushchev, de Gaulle examined the great issues of the Cold War. At odds with the Soviet Union on many matters, de Gaulle never closed the door to the possible Europeanization of Russia. He toured Russia, met several times with Khrushchev's successors, Kosygin and Brezhnev. With Germany's aging Chancellor Adenauer, de Gaulle set in motion a great project of Franco-German reconciliation. The new relationship between these two ancient enemies was formalized in what was meant to be an historic treaty. At home and abroad, he used his mystique to good advantage. When he rode with England's Queen, as he did in 1960, he seemed, if not quite a king, at least more imposing than an ordinary president. It was part of his purpose on these visits of state to replace the image of a weak and capricious France with that of a nation powerful, secure, and conscious of its destiny. The British and de Gaulle understood the importance of ceremony in these matters. As always, there was a serious purpose to de Gaulle's state visits. This time, it was to sound out Britain on its entry into the common market,
which de Gaulle was twice to veto in later years. De Gaulle's relations with the United States were at arm's length. He met President Johnson first at President Kennedy's funeral. Characteristically, de Gaulle put himself in the front rank among the crowned heads who were present. His talk with President Johnson lasted 20 minutes. It was reported to be a preliminary for a full-dress meeting in Washington later. But de Gaulle felt that by attending the funeral, he had repaid the 1960 Kennedy visit to France, and Johnson must now come to him.
We hope to pick up again the story of Charles de Gaulle's life. Right now, we break to talk again with Adalbert Segonzac, the chief correspondent of François. Mr. Segonzac, we were watching there a moment ago the involvement of France in Algeria. Charles de Gaulle came to power on a pretense at that time, did he not?
Well, I wouldn't agree with the pretense. He came into power, undoubtedly, on a military revolt, a popular revolt in one part of France, which was Algeria. And he was brought to power by the men who were then leaders of that revolt. But then he used the normal constitutional ways to come to power. And to say that it was a pretense, I think, would be terribly exaggerated.
The reason I used that word was that he knew in advance, did he not, that he was going to make Algeria independent
This is another story. One, he came to power. One, he came to power constitutionally. He was elected by the House, by the Parliament, and he came to power in that way.
Speaking of his platform.
But what he knew, his views, curiously enough, were unknown by the people who brought him to power. People went to see him privately at Colombey les Deux Églises when he was living in the desert, far from power, and to whom he spoke openly of his feelings. What he would tell them that he considered that Algeria was a lost cause, that independence had to be given to Algeria, and that it was the only way to keep close relations between Algeria and France was to give them independence. Otherwise, it would eventually lead to a complete break between two sides of the Mediterranean, and that part of the western part of the Mediterranean is to France of tremendous importance.
Of course, the conservative generals didn't know that, did they?
The conservative generals didn't know it, and curiously enough, very few people knew it, except the people who went to see him, which were journalists, politicians which were in the wilderness like him. And therefore, in that way, I agree with you, he came to power to settle the Algerian problem, but under pretense, because in fact he hadn't got the slightest idea of doing what he was asked to do. And when we told the French people in Algiers, "I understand you," his great statement, which you saw just now on the film, he was definitely at that time thinking already in the terms of putting an end to the Algerian war.
Well, now France was bogged down in Algeria the same way the United States, in a sense, is bogged down in Vietnam. What was de Gaulle's deep feelings about the United States and Vietnam? Would he have recommended us to pull out immediately?
Well, his views on Vietnam, if you want, when he came back to power in 45, he sent General Leclerc with French troops into Indochina, and with instructions to remain only in the southern part of Vietnam, which is in fact the one which France settled to keep when there was an agreement in Geneva.
Yes.
Then in Geneva, when the end of the war was brought about, he had a feeling that a promise had been made to North Vietnamese that the agreement could only be an agreement between Vietnamese. When the Americans took over from the French, he felt slightly bitter of the fact that they were taking over completely, that they were, to a certain extent, and there were probably mistakes done on the American side, trying to rub out what was the French influence and try to put instead a British, an American influence. And he also had the feeling that this was a great mistake to bring troops at the beginning, Kennedy, Eisenhower first, and then Kennedy brought more and more men to train the Vietnamese army. And when he saw President Kennedy, and he tells it in his last memoirs, he told him that he was going to get bogged down in Vietnam, that it was a mistake, that there was an agreement which was done at Geneva, and that the only solution was to let the Vietnamese settle the problem between themselves, because nobody really understood the Vietnamese. They were a type of people, a mentality which one couldn't understand unless one was one of theirs, and to interfere in their problem was a great mistake. And he warned, as I say, Kennedy, and all his attitude has to be understood later on in that limelight, that he felt that you had to let the Vietnamese talk together and you had to follow the Geneva Agreement, which was the basis of the way, the only way, the Vietnam War could be settled. And there was no bitterness against the Americans, no feeling that if France couldn't do it, therefore the Americans couldn't do it, and therefore you mustn't do anything that would help them. It was something much deeper than that. And the other point of view, which has been expressed so often, is a very superficial and inexact one.
Thank you very much, Adelbert. I hope we can talk some more. Right now, let's go back and look at some portions on tape of the Memorial Mass as celebrated in the Notre Dame Cathedral earlier this morning.
What your book is about?
Well, I think the first thing you have to say about any revolution is what it's against. And in this case, the revolution is against the almost nightmare inhumanity of our society, as I think I feel it, and I think many other people feel it. A inhumanity that's manifested more than anything else in the official violence of our society against its own people and the violence of our society against other people in other countries. Mm-hmm. I think it's a violent society, and the revolution is an effort to make it into a peaceable society.
And you believe that that violence can be opposed by a non-violent technique, and that that's what's happening?
Not only do I believe that, but I think if you opposed violence with violence, you'd have more violence. That the whole thing is to say we don't believe in violence, we believe in treating people as human beings.
Now, this condition that we've drifted into, as you've labeled the corporate state, and even your most severe critics are inclined to agree with your analysis and perception about the nature of the so-called corporate state. As I understand it, that's a term that was coined by Mussolini to describe his regime. How has the corporate state drifted into a form that's different from the American dream?
Well, I didn't mean to refer to any other state than this one when I used the phrase, but what I mean by it is that traditional American democracy has somehow been lost, and it has been replaced by a system of administration in which the society is all amalgamated into one gigantic corporation. And whether you call one part of that the federal government, one part of that a large company, a large conglomerate corporation, it's all the same thing. It doesn't matter anymore whether you call it public or private. It's a single entity which simply exercises power against people.
Is there a danger of simplistic thinking in that, Mr. Reich? The voters were at the polls on November 3rd, and they turned out George Murphy and put in John Tunney, and they dropped Charles Goodell here in the East and put in Buckley. Isn't the process still viable? The people express themselves through the ballots?
Well, it is quite true that the people make a choice when they can, and it gives you a great deal of faith when you see that. But at the same time, I believe that the two-party system presents only the narrowest range of choice. Often, it seems to me, no real choice at all. In 1968, the people who wanted to vote against the war didn't have anybody to vote for. Today, the people who would like a basic change in our society have no one to vote for. And while there may be a better and a worse man from somebody's point of view, the major critique of the society is one that has to be outside the party system now. It isn't within the voter's choice.
Now, one of the things that is happening in this revolution, according to the book, The Greening of America, has to do with levels of consciousness. And he has labeled consciousness one, consciousness two, and consciousness three, which is the newest one. You write that consciousness 3, which is represented by the new type of people, not all of them young, but most of them young, is capable of destroying the corporate state and replacing it without violence, without seizure of political power, and that all that's needed to bring about the changes is to capture control of the corporate state, which you say now that control is held by no one.
That's right.
Now, this is what I wanted to ask. If you refer in the book to powerless people, the poor and young and minority groups, if there are powerless people, that automatically implies the existence of people who have power. Aren't they the ones in control of the corporate state?
Well, we all have power, but we don't exercise it. And, for instance, we all have power insofar as we work for this society. And if we wouldn't do the kind of work that does harm, if we would refuse to do that sort of thing, we would find we were powerful. We simply lack power if we try to work through the two-party system, the democratic system, which isn't functioning well. But we remain powerful if we act in such a way as to force the society to listen to us. So consumers have power, workers have power.
If people exercise that kind of power, should they still go to the polls, or do you think that they should turn their back on the system to that extent?
Oh, no, I don't think they should. I think they should go to the polls, and I think in due time candidates will arise who represent a more fundamental challenge to the system.
I find it hard to understand why some of your critics are so frenetically opposed to you on grounds that you are not threatening the system with violence. You specifically say that there should be no violence. And you're not urging people to abandon voting as a means of expressing themselves. I want to pursue another thing further with you in just a moment. We have to take time out now to say this is today. Where did the title come from? What does greening mean?
Well, greening means that there is a renewal or a rebirth of people. But it also means that the world into which they're reborn is a sterile, mechanical wasteland. It means that there's something that has to be made green because now it is so lifeless, so hard to be human in it. And it means that in that world, people are kind of coming to life again.
Now, the consciousnesses that you refer to, the consciousness 1 and 2 and 3, could I think a brief description of each of those states would be interesting.
I might say that I never meant by consciousness to put a label on any human being. I meant to find a way to talk about the difficulties we have in communicating with each other. And by consciousness 1, I meant that some people see the reality of this world in terms of the way society was 50 or 100 years ago. They still think, for instance, the individual can guide his own destiny, can make or break himself by his own efforts. That is, that hard work will always get you ahead, and that every man that's down and out must be a lazy man. It's an idea of individualism as the determining force. And consciousness, too, thinks that the reality is organization. And he thinks that the individual is only able to survive insofar as he finds himself a place in an organization. But his mistake of reality is to think that a man who has a place, say he's a vice president, that by itself is happiness, that by itself is satisfaction, that is meaning. And so he's mistaken the title and the status for the real condition of human satisfaction. And it's consciousness 3 that says we want to return to what is basically human. But we want to do so in full recognition we live in a technological society. So consciousness 3 isn't the same as 1 because it knows we live in a complex world. But it still says no matter how complicated the world, the duty of people is to be human before anything else.
Hmm. So consciousness 1 would be somewhat equated with the frontier mentality and
lag. That is that people's idea of reality is way behind the actualities because our world changes so fast. And so people tend to think of the world in terms of their own boyhood or childhood.
Is there anything about consciousness 3 that would help with the speed of change? In other words,